The United Nations says that Israel has demolished some 45 Palestinian structures in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds in the past 2 weeks. Iran's president rules out the possibility of holding talks with a U.S. president in New York, saying that Biden's policies are no different from those of his predecessor. Plus, the British government's move to invite Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to Queen Elizabeth's funeral raises controversy. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The Tel Aviv regime keeps destroying Palestinian homes, and that's part of its land grab policy. According to the United Nations, authorities in Tel Aviv have destroyed 44 homes in the occupied West Bank, including in Al-Quds, in the past 2 weeks alone, 20 of them without prior notice. As a result, dozens of Palestinians have become homeless. Israel routinely destroys Palestinian structures for lack of permit that are next to impossible to obtain. It also demolishes the homes of Palestinians who are involved in anti-Israel operations. Human rights campaigners call the move collective punishment. The demolitions are also seen as part of efforts to make room for illegal settlements. Now from Ramallah, Mona Kandil has the details about the latest Israeli demolitions.
Between the period 30 of August until 12 September, as you have mentioned, 44 Palestinian homes had been destroyed in Area C of the occupied West Bank that is supposed to be under Palestinian Authority control or under the Palestinian control and part of the future Palestinian state, and some 9 or 12 homes were demolished in Al-Quds. The main reason, or the real reasons for the ongoing demolition of Palestinian homes for the lack of Israeli-issued permits is because Israel wants to confiscate the lands, give it to nearby illegal settlements to expand the settlements or build in new settler settlements or settler units, or even for using these lands for military purpose, or even to, open new settler, only settler roads, so Palestinians are forced to leave their homes in order to allow the settlers to build a new settler unit.
Now, we've discussed the latest regional and global developments with the Deputy Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah. One of the issues inevitably raised was the status and the fate of the Tel Aviv regime. Sheikh Naim Qassem says the resistance has been going from strength to strength, and Israel is no longer the determining force in conflicts and wars. He added that while the regime used to wage battles outside the occupied territories, it now has to fight them inside Israel. The Sheikh said the resistance missiles can now reach every point in the occupied Palestine, including Tel Aviv. He said that Israel's biggest ally, the United States, is also seeing its influence wane. He noted that the U.S. has lost all the wars and battles it's launched in recent times, including those in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. Sheikh Qassem also pointed out that U.S. sanctions against countries like Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela have all failed. A diplomatic spat is intensified between Chile and Israel over the regime's killing of Palestinians. The dispute started on Thursday when the Chilean president put off accepting the credentials of Israel's new ambassador. The foreign ministry said it was a sensitive day because of the killing of a 17-year-old Palestinian by Israeli forces near the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. In response, Israeli foreign ministry summoned the Chilean ambassador for what it called a reprimand. It criticized the unprecedented behavior and warned that it would seriously harm relations. The Palestinian Authority has welcomed the Chilean president's position, saying that such moves can put pressure on Israel to stop its daily crimes. Hamas's movement also hailed the move, calling on all countries to sever their ties with the occupying regime. Israel has killed more than 150 Palestinians this year alone. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has ruled out a possibility of a meeting or talks with his U.S. counterpart Joe Biden during his upcoming trip to New York.
You're off to New York. You're going to speak at the United Nations. You know, President Biden is going to be there. Are you open to a meeting with President Biden, a face-to-face?
فکر نمی کنم چنین.
No, I don't think that such a meeting would happen.
نه ملاقات رو و نه مذاکره رو.
I don't believe having a meeting or talk with him will be beneficial.
Rice says that there is no difference between the administrations of Joe Biden and his predecessor Donald Trump, because Biden has carried out the same policies. The Iranian president is scheduled to address the 77th session of the UN General Assembly in the coming days. Back in 2018, Trump launched a so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran after withdrawing from the 2015 deal, the JCPOA. He also reimposed anti-Iran sanctions. Iran says that the JCPOA revival hinges on the removal of sanctions and guarantees that Washington won't exit the accord again as it did before. Time now for the news review. The British government is facing a barrage of criticism for inviting Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to attend Queen Elizabeth's funeral. The criticism centers around MBS's role in the murder and dismemberment of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Khashoggi's fiancé is calling for bin Salman to be arrested for murder when he arrives in London. Hatice Cengiz says that the Saudi Crown Prince should be denied the opportunity to seek legitimacy and normalization by attending the Queen's funeral. Rise campaigners are also citing excessive domestic repression in Saudi Arabia's deadly war on Yemen. The London-based Campaign Against Arms Trade says that the occasion gives bin Salman another chance to whitewash his human rights record. The Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy is echoing similar concerns. The institute has called bin Salman a notorious Persian Gulf despot who presides over appalling violations against dissidents. Now to discuss this, I will be joined by a couple of guests. Our own colleague in London, Amina Taylor, is with me. Fra Hugh, journalist and author and activist, also joining me from Belfast. Good to see you both. So Amina, beginning with you, tell us about the Rise Group's reactions, media coverage regarding this controversial visit by MBS.
Well, it is interesting for me to note that despite the proven atrocities that have been committed by Riyadh, we still have a situation here where, when it comes to one of the most viewed, one of the most observed and carefully choreographed state funerals, as the one with Queen Elizabeth II taking place tomorrow will be, with dignitaries invited from all over the globe, we have a man who will be sitting front and center, who is directly responsible for one of the most atrocious assassinations in memory. I mean, the details were simply sickening in terms of just the planning and preparation that came into and went into the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey in 2018. We're talking about a man who has decided with his aides and his old army chiefs to intensify the bombardment of one of the country's most poor region and blockade the Yemenis and ensure that hundreds of thousands would have been malnourished, would have been starving, would have been open to the elements. COVID was such a terrible time for that country as well. And here he will sit in his princely robe, rubbing shoulders with some of the great and the good and the questionable across the globe. I think one of the things we have to realize, when Britain makes these decisions, it's not that they're not acknowledging that this man, as the Bahraini Institute for Peace described as a despot of the Persian Gulf region, but he is our despot. He is our butcher. He is our guy in the region. And herein lies the difference. Not all human rights violators are treated in the same way. I think it is very difficult to look at what will be happening tomorrow and feel anything other than an intense shame at the double standard, which is so frequently and commonly used by this country. There's no getting around it. It's not like we don't know. We know, but we're like, okay, but he's our guy, so let him sit right beside Jacinda Arnold from New Zealand or Justin Trudeau. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Fra, how do you look at this? I mean, given all those rights violations, some of the instances, I mean, I just mentioned, and you know better also, So, and also, is it money versus human rights, only claims of human rights? Because Saudis are great purchases of weaponry from the U.S., from the U.K. and others. So what is it that makes the British authorities want to invite such a person to attend this funeral?
Yes, well, there is the old saying that when money talks, justice walks. I saw some details. There were arms licenses for £7.1 billion were issued between the start of the Saudi Arabian bombing of Yemen in May 2015 up until, I think it was June 2022. So there are 7.1 billion reasons why they're going to invite Mohammed bin Salman to London for the Queen's interment. I think also it's, for me, it's very much a case of birds of a feather flocking together. If you look at the history of the British royal family and its military imperialist connections with the government, you have had Prince Andrew fight in the war in the Falklands. You had Prince Harry fighting in the war in against Afghanistan. You had the former Prince Charles, now King Charles, was head of the British Parachute Regiment that murdered 10 people in Ballymurphy in 1971, unarmed civilians, and the same platoon and the same regiment murdered 14 civilians in Derry on the 30th of January, 1972. The inquest into the murders of the people from Ballymurphy is only beginning its process 50 years after it happened, 51 years. So what we have is a financial interest through the House of Saud. We have the creation of the House of Saud, I believe, with British help after the fall of the Ottoman Empire in 1918, at the end of the First World War and the Sykes-Picot Agreement. So what you have is a state, or several states of the Gulf monarchies, who are pro-British and pro-Western and pro the British establishment and Western imperialist machinations within the region. And maybe finally, if I could just tie in, you know, the monarchy of Saudi Arabia with the monarchy of the United Kingdom. There is a photograph circulating on social media which shows the former Prince Charles with James Savile, Jimmy Savile, a BBC children's television presenter, who after his death was accused by many of the children that he was in contact with of being a paedophile. Also in the photograph is Thomas Hamilton, the man who's known as the Dunblane shooter. He murdered 16 school children. He went into a classroom and shot them, one teacher, and injured 15 others. So when you put that together with Lord Mountbatten, who is the was the uncle of the former Prince Charles, who was killed by the IRA, he was accused of being a paedophile as well, with accusations that he visited a children's home called Kincora in Belfast. So, you know, the human rights violations of the House of Saud are mirrored in many respects with the violations by the monarchy and the crown in Britain, which continues today.
Okay, for sure. Comments and insight. Amina Taylor in London, Fra Hughes in Belfast. Shock and outrage has spread across the British black community as an investigation into the police shooting of an unarmed black man in South London has started. Chris Cabot was killed at in early this month. His death, as many activists claim, it was an unjust killing by a racist police force. Robert Carter reports at the latest protests in London.
British police have found themselves embroiled in another racism scandal, this time surrounding the killing of an unarmed black man in South London by armed officers on the 5th of September. Following an alleged police pursuit, 24-year-old Chris Carver was behind the wheel of a car hemmed in by two police vehicles in a narrow street before one round was fired, ending his life. He leaves behind a fiancée and an unborn child. No gun was found in the car.
Thousands of protesters have descended outside police headquarters in central London to vent their fury over what they say is gross injustice being carried out by the authorities against Chris and his family. Accusations are swirling around, some of which include that the police who stopped Chris on that fateful day may have known who was inside the car in the lead-up to the fatal shooting. This is, of course, all being investigated, but the protest organisers have made absolutely clear that they are going to refuse to back down until the demands of the family are met and justice be served.
Fighting back the tears, family members spoke of their ordeal after seeing the body for the first time since the killing.
On behalf of the family, I want to thank everyone for coming. Mum and dad couldn't make it. Emotionally, it was just too much for them. But they did send a message saying thank you and that they appreciate all your love and support and your kindness, and it means the world to them, especially during these trying times. As you know, a lot of you know that yesterday we did go to see the body.
News of the shooting has caused uproar, especially in the black community. They feel this was just another example of a racist system out to harm them.
Do you know what? Thank goodness that they have decided not to arm the entire police force, because if that was the case, then I think that would be a cause for concern. Because obviously they're demonstrating themselves to be quite trigger happy.
Following the backlash, the officer responsible for the shooting has been suspended. An investigation is also underway, but the police watchdog warned it could take 9 months to reach a conclusion. The family expressed anger at the lengthy wait. However, the question of race playing a role will be examined as a factor, providing some small hope that the family's demands will be answered. Robert Carter, London.
Major oil companies operating in the United States are accused of lying to the public about their plans to help advance climate goals. A congressional investigation into the role of fossil fuels in the climate crisis has obtained documents from oil giants ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, and BP. In those documents, the oil firms have admitted to manipulating the public over purported attempts to go green. They've even wished that critical activists, in their own words, be infested by bedbugs. This is the third congressional hearing on how the fossil fuel industry has been trying to hamper efforts to address the climate crisis. Last year, lawmakers called top executives from the oil companies to testify, but they denied they misled the public.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we saw how herbicides used by the Australian government decimated its employees and left children and partners critically ill. Assured by the government that it was safe, it was common for Australian workers in the 60s and 70s to use toxic herbicides without using proper protective clothing. Since then, a terrifyingly high number of these former government employees have died or become seriously ill, almost certainly as a result of their constant exposure to dioxin, a deadly chemical impurity found in herbicide 2,4,5-T. Of course, 2,4,5-T has now been banned, but stay with us as we investigate how a lack of regulation and testing of cheap imports means potentially deadly levels of the dioxin may still be present in weed control products today.
Yeah, all clear there and left me.
Yep.
Molly Dunn believes she knows more than most in Yarram about the toxic aftermath of spraying 2,4,5-T and 2,4-D. She had a stillborn baby 5 months into a pregnancy. At the time, her husband Percy Dunn was a sprayer for the Victorian Lands Department at Yarram.
They didn't actually have protective clothing back then. No clothes, no masks, nothing much, you know.
Percy Dunn died of cancer in 1980. The 60-year-old had been ill for many years after spraying the herbicides in paddocks and along creeks to kill blackberries and ragwort weed infestations. 2 years after he died, Molly took the Victorian government to court and was awarded $17,500 in workers' compensation. But no liability was admitted. All these years later, she's still grieving his death. Percy Dunn's family is believed to be the only one in Yarram to have received government compensation.
Do you think it's wrong that families like yours only get compensation when they're prepared to go to court?
Yeah, well, that's the government, isn't it? They don't want to pay out anything unless they have to.
And there'd be surpluses in those drums too.
It's very similar to the asbestos cases that I've been involved in. The denial is put forward and the worker's got a battle to prove beyond reasonable doubt. And it's very hard to do in chemical cases.
In Yarram, many of the sprayers have died.
Very short breath though.
Yeah, well, me too.
Tony Cassidy and Pat Reed are the lucky ones, sick but still alive.
Anyway, he's looking at you, Doc.
Righto.
I've got cancer of the bladder. In fact, I've got to go tomorrow for more exploratory surgery.
How many of your mates that you used to spray with have been sick or have died?
Oh, well, all of them are sick. Some are probably not as sick as me, but they're all sick. And I'd say probably 75% of them have died.
Any breeze, well, you've got it all over you. You're wet through some bloody days.
What, just covered in the stuff?
Yeah.
Sprayer Pat Reed thinks he was unwittingly dragged into a cover-up when he was told by his boss to bury about 80 of the drums on Crown land just outside of Yarram.
Tree over there, the clean one.
Oh, right, OK.
About there? Yeah.
You can Pat took us to the site of where he buried them more than 30 years ago.
They put the axe through them up on the truck and threw them into the hole and they crunched them up with a dozer and then filled it all in.
Nothing there.
We knew there was something going on, digging a hole out to put drums in, so something funny.
Out in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah.
Why do you think the Lands Department asked the men to bury the drums?
The drums there.
Because the heat was on. Get rid of them. We don't want them on the premises because people were starting to snip around and ask questions.
It should never have been used for manual spraying or aerial spraying. It was a poison that you couldn't contain.
It wasn't until the 1990s that 2,4,5-T, which was thought to be more toxic than 2,4-D, was banned by all states in Australia. This was some years after the United States took it off its market. What made 245T so toxic was the heating of the reaction mixture during manufacture, which created dangerous dioxins.
You can not ensure that dioxins are not being formed even if you employ the best production processes. I think this is one of the reasons why 245T was banned, because what you require is an additional step, which is a purification step, and that is relatively costly.
Kills the entire weed, roots and all.
What many people don't realise is that the second chemical in Agent Orange, 24D, which was developed in the 1940s, is still widely used.
A plane dusts a field of young wheat with 24D.
24D is a cheap and effective weed killer.
The destruction of many weeds is complete.
There are more than 200 24D products registered in Australia.
It's used in many agricultural applications. It's used in pastures and cropland for broadleaf control. It's also used in areas that people probably wouldn't expect, such as turf spraying for sporting fields, for councils in their cosmetic applications, for verges and those sorts of things.
Many of the major chemical companies are represented by a peak body, CropLife Australia.
Weeds are a massive cost. If you had to manage them in other ways, we're talking, you know, just for a normal farm, thousands of work hours.
Hey there.
Hi.
So this is the sample.
Great.
It's generally assumed that there's no dangerous dioxins in 24D due to today's improved manufacturing standards. But 3 years ago, a team of Queensland scientists set out to prove there were no dioxins in pesticides and were amazed at what they discovered.
We actually didn't believe the results. We said there must have been a cross-contamination because these levels are not possible anymore today. They were, for some of the pesticides, similar to what was known from 245T, which was banned in the 80s, 90s.
Associate Professor Carolyn Gall sent her researchers back to the laboratory to repeat the tests. And when they returned positive, she expanded the study to include other pesticides, including 24D. Tests on one 24D product came back showing moderate levels of dioxins. This product was made by a Brisbane company, but it may have had its active ingredient imported. There's no way of knowing, as the regulator classifies this as commercial in confidence. Many Australian companies today import their active ingredients from countries like China and India.
What that really means is that it depends on the manufacturer, as well as the year of manufacture, as well as the batch or the country of manufacture, on how much dioxin you actually produce or have left as an impurity in the 24D formulation.
We've been told many, many times over the years that industry has cleaned up its act, that they have new processing equipment, new techniques, new technology that will eliminate dioxin from their herbicides and therefore from our environment. But I think the latest studies that are showing these contaminant levels indicate that that's not the case. The industry hasn't come clean about the nature of the contaminants of dioxin in 24D, and the government really needs to take a close look at this.
Despite the low to moderate levels found in 24D, its widespread use rang alarm bells.
So if you have a moderate toxicity but you use very high volumes, then the risk could be the same as having very high toxicity but very low volume of use.
24D was tested, and the level of dioxins that were found were lower than elsewhere in the world. So that gave us some comfort.
That gave you some comfort?
Some comfort.
That they found moderate levels of dioxin in 24D.
That it was low to moderate.
The regulator, the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, decided to see for itself if dioxins were present. It repeated the Queensland tests.
The APVMA came in and also tested for dioxins in a range of chemicals, and we worked with the health department as well in assessing the outcomes of that. And
when you tested, did you find dioxins as well?
I understand that when the testing was done, we did find some levels of dioxins, and that's when it's been referred to the health department.
Did you find it in 2,4-D?
I would have to... I don't know the answer to that question.
Exposure to dioxin is consistent with this pattern of adverse health effects, and I think that there are solid scientific reasons to be concerned about dioxin exposures following 2,4-D use.
Four Corners decided to test for dioxin contamination in one of the many imported products. We purchased 2,4-D weed killer from this warehouse in Sunshine just outside of Melbourne and sent it to government laboratories for testing.
The 2,4-D weed killer, Aminos 625, was imported from China by an Australian company, Senonda, based in an office in Melbourne. We purchased the 2,4-D weed killer, which is often sold direct to farmers, no questions asked.
It's almost 3 weeks on, and we've just received our results from the government laboratory. Alarmingly, our sample of 2,4-D weed killer came back with dioxin levels almost seven times higher than those found by the Queensland scientists. And what's even more disturbing is we don't know how many contaminated 2,4-D products are out there in the community because authorities are not routinely testing.
Four Corners gave the results to Associate Professor Carolyn Gauss to analyse.
I was actually surprised because you only analysed one formulation and actually returned such a high result. I thought it was unlikely today, but again, that is a reality check when we think back to our previous study where we actually didn't expect any contamination in the pesticides. It just demonstrates again that what we're seeing today is equally or even worse than 10 to 20 years ago, and that is of concern, of course.
Each year, more than $100 million worth of 2,4-D products are sold in Australia, and we don't know which ones contain imported ingredients.
We have seen a new scenario develop in Australia with high Australian dollar, massive production increase in places like China, and fairly free trade between the two countries, that a large amount of product is now coming in. The country of origin, as I suggested, doesn't automatically imply good or bad. What we do need to ensure is that we deal with reliable suppliers.
But it's not just about having a reliable supplier. Scientists say we should be monitoring for dioxins in all pesticides, and that's the job of the regulator.
Without monitoring each of the batches or regular monitoring, we pretty much don't have any chance to really realise what is being on the market and how much of the dioxin is being released with pesticide use.
The APVMA hasn't found any evidence of high levels of dioxin in imported chemicals.
Are you testing for it?
The APVMA doesn't do independent testing. However, it is concerns about potential quality of imported goods is often referred to us from many different sources.
But how do you know if they've got dangerous dioxins in them?
If there were high levels of dioxins, it would affect the final chemical, and we would expect to see in the public use concerns about the efficacy or the chemical itself, and we're not seeing that.
Who should test for dioxin in these imports, the companies or the regulator?
Well, I would suggest that any regulatory system should have an independent testing regime to it.
We also don't know how much 2,4-D is being sprayed around Australia.
The lack of volume data makes it really hard to make any kind of sensible risk management decisions. If you've got a chemical where there's an identified problem and you don't know how much is being used or where it's used or in what circumstances it's being used, it's very difficult to develop sensible regulatory, make sensible regulatory decisions.
I would suggest to you those who are advocating the need for it don't realise that it's actually not necessary, or in fact you're just going to bury the regulator in data and them not able to make a good decision.
Regardless of how much is sprayed, it's too much for David Brewer, an organic wine producer in South Australia's Riverland. Last year at Loxton, he lost his entire harvest because 2,4-D sprayed on another property drifted onto his grapes. David Brewer used to lecture in chemistry at Roseworthy Agricultural College in South Australia.
it's a foreign chemical, it's something that we would have no part of, and yet it's on our grapes, it's on our sultanas, and it can only have come from somebody else's property. It's a trespass.
Tests found that David Brewer's table grapes had very small residues of 2,4-D. But he's concerned it could have been one of the cheaper generic imported products.
What is it about these imported 2,4-D products that are so attractive?
Well, A, they're cheap. They're cheaper to start with, and B, they go further, so they're more efficient, if you like, in killing weeds.
But more effective in contaminating other properties as
Absolutely.
Well.
Yeah, that's a real problem. Like, once it's finished at their place, it comes over here and has a go at ours.
There was a ban on spraying 2,4-D esters, the most prone to drift, at the time David Brewer's grapes were contaminated. It's almost impossible to trace the origins of vapour drift, as it can travel up to 100 kilometres.
Well, most cases of spray drift are usually because people aren't obeying the what's on the label, or it could be accidental.
2,4-D drift has damaged thousands of hectares of cotton, market gardens and vineyards around the country. The South Australian market gardener, who does not want to be named for fear of losing customers, says he's constantly losing produce from drift from farms as far as 10 kilometres away.
The cos leather's growing nicely.
Bottom line is, they can't use a chemical that does damage to other people. There is no compensation for anybody that gets damaged, so it should really be eliminated.
You can see the weird growth deformations. It's got these protruding growths sticking out from the side of the tomato.
This grower says the drift is causing many deformities in his vegetables.
You've got female where they're supposed to be male, so they're mixed up with the pollen. And you also do get corn deformities where you'll get multiple cobs on a single cob.
The mysterious part of it is that 2,4-D can render significant damage to a vineyard, a cherry orchard, a tomato field, at levels that can't be measured in the air. It's that toxic to plants, particularly if the drift and exposure episode occurs when the plant is going through the fruiting stage. In other words, the plant's flowering, beginning to form fruit.
7 years ago, the Australian regulator put restrictions on when and how 2,4-D high volatile esters could be sprayed. But the complaints of drift continued. Curiously, the day Four Corners was to interview the regulator, it announced a proposed ban on high volatile esters.
We're going through a show cause process to ask industry to come back to us with why these chemicals should still be available, and from then we will make the decision about the future of the chemicals in Australia.
But some believe a ban will not go far enough, as there are other forms of 2,4-D that may drift that are still on the market. The APVMA started a review of 2,4-D in 1995 because of concerns about its potential harmful effects on humans, animals and the environment. It's yet to finish that review.
Why do you announce that you're going to review a chemical in 1995 but you don't do anything until 2006?
As I mentioned, I can't comment on what was behind that announcement. Typically when you come to chemical review, if you're concerned about a chemical, you do announce to the public that you are looking at such a chemical.
11 years ahead of time.
That sort of time frame is perhaps unusual.
Australia's regulator must walk a fine line between arming farmers with the best tools and protecting the community from potentially dangerous chemicals. Today, there's almost 10,000 agricultural chemicals used in Australia. Some, like 2,4-D, have been around for generations.
It is not acceptable that chemicals take 10 or 15 years for review when there have been identified problems with them.
What are the risks?
Well, the risks are that unsafe chemicals are being continually put in the environment, being used in farming communities, and we are eating those in the food that we eat.
some would say the time to take a risk with these old chemicals is over. Certainly Nigel Sinclair and his family believed this. Tragically, Nigel never got the answers he was seeking. He died shortly after our interview.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that it is an unfair equation to lose valuable human life just to get rid of weeds. And that's it for this week's program. Thank you for your time and attention. Until next week at another Aperture, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, Salamun alaikum, welcome to this episode of Lantern. Now, on the continuation of this program, Lantern, we have a nice story. Let's listen to it. The Monkey and the Dolphin. One day, long ago, some sailors set out to sea in their sailing ship. One of them brought his pet monkey along for the long journey. When they were far out at the sea, a terrible storm overturned their ship. Everyone fell into the sea, and the monkey was sure that he would drown. Suddenly, a dolphin appeared and picked him up. They soon reached the island, and the monkey came down from the dolphin's back. The dolphin asked the monkey, "Do you know this place?" The monkey replied, Yes, I do. In fact, the king of the island is my best friend. Do you know that I'm actually a prince? Knowing that no one lived on the island, the dolphin said, "Well, well, so you are a prince. Now you can be a king." The monkey asked, "How can I be a king?" As the dolphin started swimming away, he answered, "That is easy. As you are the only creature on this island, you will naturally be the king. Those who lie and boast may end up in trouble." Now, on the continuation of this program, Lantern, we'll listen to the scholar's note on this story. Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bin astain. Telling lies is, first of all, moral wise. Now, we find that there are, certain aspects that should be studied in this regard. One of them is that, what are the cases of, what are the reasons for telling lies, and what are the unfavorable consequences of telling lies. As for telling lies, as for some of the causes motives of telling lies, we can say that some people are very much scared of having their own personalities being revealed, and as they don't want their real face to be revealed to other people, they start telling lies. Or sometimes they might imagine that through telling lies they would gain some benefits. So we find that there are at least two reasons for telling lies. One of them is, having a sense of being afraid of having one's own real face disclosed to the community. And another one is that the people may want to gain some benefits, however transitory or small. There may be some other reasons. For example, sometimes they might want to hide some truths from other people. And instead of saying that they are not that much informed, they start telling lies. And particularly when they tell lies, they don't have, a good memory in order to remember what they had said. So next time or somewhere else or after some time, when the same question is asked in a different way, just paraphrased, you find that what they say is totally different from what they had told before. In this case, we find that we have to know what are the unfavorable consequences of telling lies. Some people believe that some lack of balance in the community, in the human community, and at the same time, the widespread of a certain, individual and social sins in the community, both in the in individuals, individuals' inclination to commit some sins and the widespread of those sins in the community, may be among the causes of telling lies. At the same time, we find that some other people say that it might be because of individuals, people's inclination to commit sins. In both cases, we find that telling lies cannot be justified in any way. Although everybody is expected to tell nothing but the truth, but not all truth should be revealed and told anywhere. There must be some prudence. For example, if you tell the truth to, for example, a little child, this little child, because of his or her inexperience in life, may misunderstand it and may, it might have some other unfavorable consequences. In other cases, for example, if you, in some cases, if you tell the truth, some other unfavorable consequences might happen. For example, when a student fails in a course and his or her teacher knows that, if the student get informed of his or her real mark, he or she might commit suicide. Well, to be on the safe side, this teacher may circumvent the event and may pretend that he or she simply doesn't remember that student's mark.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So we find that in addition to not revealing anything, or in addition to being very much, concerned with the life and, life and death of people and the critical situations in the community, we find that there are some unfavorable consequences regarding telling lies. And at the same time, we find that those people who are in the habit of telling lies, they are not reliable. According to Imam Ali alayhi salam, the first infallible Imam Ali alayhi salam, a person who tells lies, he pictures something which is very far from you, quite close to you, and vice versa. Now we find that another unfavorable consequence of telling lies is hypocrisy. Those people who tell lies are most, apt to develop a personality of, hypocrite people. According to a piece of hadith from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, telling lies is one of the gates to hypocrisy. And in this connection, we find that, those people who tell lies, they experience, inadequate provisions from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This might be one of the, consequences or further consequences, both individual and social consequences of telling lies. And in support of this, there's a piece of hadith from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam who said, telling lies decreases one's provisions. According to a great majority of Muslim scholars and scholars in the realm of Islamic ethics, the social consequences or the social, the unfavorable consequences of telling lies is greater, is much greater than, individual effects and individual significance on people. However, on the individual plane or on the individual level, we find that those people who tell lies are usually deprived of performing supplementary midnight salat, salat al-layl. And at the same time, we find that, those people who tell lies are really faceless in their own communities. And in this regard, we find that telling lies is a moral vice that should strictly be avoided. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innu al-qulub.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.